It's the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. It's February 15th, 2006, approximately 20 after 10 a.m. We're at the Frank Dreyer Greenhouse across the street from Local 602. Why don't we let everybody else know who's in the room?
Earl Nicholson.
Gary Judy.
Jerry Smith.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fedewa.
And this is Cheryl McQuaid. Douglas Rademacher, could you state your name and spell your last name for us?
Doug Rademacher, R-A-D-E-M-A-C-H-E-R.
And what is your address?
The address is 2310 Woodruff Avenue, Lansing, Michigan, 48912.
You're a male. Are you married?
Yes, I am. I've been married for 26 years, and I have two children, two daughters, 23 and 19.
Where were you born?
I was born right here in Lansing, Michigan at St. Lawrence Hospital. I lived in Williamston until I was 5 years old, but I was born here in Lansing.
What year was that?
I was born in 1959, and my parents moved to Lansing when I was 5 years old, and I grew up about 3.5 blocks from the Fisher Body Plant and attended Holy Cross Grade School and Lansing Catholic Central High School.
Speaking of your parents, what did they do?
My father worked for his brother, who owned a liquor store here in Lansing. It's called Tulin's Delicatessen. And my mother worked for the state of Michigan, downtown Lansing.
Did you spend any time in the military?
No, I have no military experience other than that my father was taught weaponry in the Army, so as I grew up, it felt like I was in the military.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background, your education, growing up in the area at Fisher Body?
Well, yes, as I said, I lived quite close to the Fisher plant. Holy Cross School and Church was on Saginaw and Jennison, so I just walked straight to school every day in the morning. And then at seventh grade, I went to what became Lansing Catholic Central. They merged the two Catholic high schools in Lansing, and I went there the first year that they had joined the two schools together, and I was the first graduate of the combined of 7th through 12th. In 1977, I graduated.
So what were some of the things you did as a kid in the neighborhood?
We had a lot of fun in this neighborhood, and we played. There's a lot of boulevards, a lot of the neighborhoods they were connected to the St. Lawrence Hospital. The doctors live nearby. There's nice homes and things up in this area. And so we played, met the local kids. We played ball. One of the things I remember was my friends and I would gather at this little spot behind a place called Harry's Bar, and there was an open lot. It's not very large at all, but at our age, if we could put the ball into the parking lot of the Harry's Bar, it was a home run. And one occasion we put the ball in the parking lot and broke the back window out of the owner's window of his Delta 88. And we all went sprinting away in fear. You know how all the kids run, and then one of the kids who's was the son of the mayor of Lansing. Jerry Graves was the mayor, and his son Billy went back and owned up to the event. But we had lots of fun in this neighborhood.
Did that car belong to a Fisher Body employee, or?
No, it was the owner of the Harry's Bar establishment. Art is his name. I don't remember his last name properly.
And So living that close to the plant, you must have walked by. Did you have any interaction with the employees?
Absolutely. Again, with my father having the store, I was always into finding a way to make money. And so the Fisher Body Plant always had such large traffic. We'd come up and check the barrels in front of the shop. As kids, we'd pull out beer and pop bottles out of there and take them to my dad's store and get all the money for candy, which there used to be a D&C, a diamond cent, I think that's what they were called back then, store across from my father's the liquor store. So it was, had a wonderful candy counter and all these little separate compartments. It was again, a kid's paradise. So we'd find ways to get money. Back then, beer bottles were worth 2 cents. If you had a 7-Up was in a green bottle, that was worth 3 cents, and a quart bottle of beer was a brown bottle was worth a nickel. So we would go through all the barrels and up and down the street here, and people always were throwing those away, so it was money in our pocket. That was early on.
Where was your father's store located?
Tulin's is located on Saginaw Street. It's approximately maybe about 10 blocks from the Fisher plant. And I worked 4 years there during my high school years, but met many of the people I ended up working with. They would come in on a regular basis on their lunch breaks or before work. And so I met many of the people through the store that once I hired into Fisher Body, I recognized them from coming into my father and my uncle's store all the time.
What kind of jobs did you have before you hired in?
Well, I guess the first thing to think about is growing up 3 blocks away. I was a paper boy, and I delivered the Lansing State Journal in the afternoon, and I delivered the Detroit Free Press in the morning before school, and that covered a large part of this surrounding neighborhood. So I was always around the plant. One of my deliveries came down what would be North Genesee and the Osborne streets, which come right down next to Verlinden Grade School and so forth. So I was by the plant all the time. That would have been my first jobs. And I was a hustler. I'd go out there and solicit people to take the paper. And I was a good little salesman. I won a few trips to a dude ranch down in Indiana. I went to opening day at Tiger Stadium. Went up to Lake Michigan for a cookout and stuff. So I was just a little, always after trying to find a way to make a buck, even as a kid. So that was my first job. Following that, I did work for New York Carpet World as a measure man, cut remnants and so forth. And I'd go into a home, measure the room, draw it on graph paper, and measure the room, and then the people would come in and order their carpet accordingly from a salesman. Following that, I went to work for the department. State of Michigan was the Commerce Center down on Capitol Avenue, and I worked as an account clerk 05 for a period of time doing, I guess it was unemployment and public assistance. And I balanced counties to the checks that were being written. And from there, I did a two-week stint. I went into a place called National Welding, and I had got the information about hiring in there from my to-be wife. Her sister worked there, and they needed someone to do payroll. So I hired in there, got my own office, started to do what they call equalization of hours and balancing out the hours charged to a company and their job and divided amongst the workers. And then I got a call from General Motors. And I stood in line, and Fisher Body had called me, and I quit that job over the weekend, called the boss at home. She wasn't in. I left the message with her son, and I never went back. So I don't know where I might have been had I stayed in accounting-type duties. But
Doug, from working with you this past year, I've heard a lot of stories about the neighborhood around General Motors. Could you tell us a little bit about being raised in this neighborhood? What was it like having a house three blocks from the plant?
Since I was 5 years old, I really didn't know anything else. The plant was always there. It was huge. And we had the public high school, Sexton, was right nearby. There was always a lot of traffic. There was always things going on. Trucks, trains. We'd play down at the local schoolyards. Verlinden had some ball diamonds and stuff. We'd get down in there and we'd see all the trucks on the weekends. We'd come down. As we got older, we'd ride our mini bikes in the parking lot on Sundays. They'd allow us, sometimes they'd kick us out, but the security, we could come in and use the wide open parking lot. Being a city kid, there was no other place to ride those. But we would grow up spending time. You can picture a group of kids, young guys hanging out. We'd climb in the semis that were parked out back and fool around the train tracks. It was a while before they had put in the new Oakland and Saginaw Street ran side by side, and they put a bridge in. And one of the funnest things as a kid was to be able to stand on top of the bridge, and they're one-way streets going about 40 miles an hour, and we'd throw snowballs straight down on top of vehicles, and there was nowhere for them to stop. And that was one of our biggest fun times. But we used to do a lot of crazy little things, but they weren't real bad, but it was... a few times we had vehicles had to go up to the top of the viaduct and pull over. There was no place to really come and get us because we were so far back on the railroad tracks. But we just had little pranks that we'd do. And there was an ice cream parlor called Tasty Freeze. We'd spend a lot of time there, and you could see the plant and the parking lots, and people would always be coming in. And the old Paramount News Center. So we'd slip in there and read books and stuff like that. Try to get someone to try to buy cigars or something. I remember one time we bought a little pack of Winchester cigars and crossed the street and sat at the American Bank and Trust. And some parent, as always, they caught us and took them away from us. It's like, even if your parents weren't there, somebody was always watching out for what was going on in the neighborhood and taking care of the kids, keeping an eye out.
So being a neighborhood child, plant security would allow you certain privileges?
I don't know if it was privileges. One security guard that comes to mind is there was a guy that was a year older than me, Frank Della Pia. He ended up coming to work at the plant and then moving on into engineering and higher management. But his father was a security guard. He lived on Jennison Street also, and I always remember... he would always meet his dad walking home from the plant, which was probably another additional block than further than I was. But I just remember him always seeing his dad come down the street in his uniform and thinking how neat it was, and never realized what was going on in the building. But on Verlinden Avenue, we'd play ball and at that little park, and then we'd come across to the security gate in the front and go down, and that water was always so cold down in the front. We'd get down in there and just... so I always... you saw the guard shack type of area. It was inside the building, just inside. They'd check us out, but they'd let us have a drink, and we'd sometimes, talk a little bit, make conversation. And then later on in the years, after we got older, of course, when the line would be running, more like in the summer... when we had the time off, we'd hang around the front of the building. In the old days, the building had windows all the way down. We're only 4 feet, 5 feet off the ground, I guess 4 feet. There'd always been bushes and plants all along the front, but you used to be able to go up and peek in the windows. And they were big and green, but they'd open out so you could stick your head up and kind of be looking inside the building. And occasionally the workers inside would hoot and holler and have fun with us and spray us and stuff like that with hoses or things like that. But I remember my friend Eddie Lira. He lived only a block and a half or so from the plant in the first block there. And his grandfather worked in there. I don't know his first name, but we used to come up and bring him stuff up and pass it through the window. So there was always interaction with the workers.
What kind of stuff would you pass through the window?
Oh, it's usually limes and stuff. Maybe his lunch, stuff like that.
Do you remember much about the environment around the plant?
Well, yeah. It's a diverse area, and even though we were all real close, it was kind of racially divided as far as neighborhoods, and you kind of had particular parameters that you would, me being white and then the blacks would be just north or just south of Michigan Avenue. And you just was a known thing that you just was, in those days, we're talking in the 60s and up into the early 70s, there was racial unrest. And so there was always a hint of concern or fear, or it actually was fear, that didn't want to get yourself in a situation. But my paper route that I had in the morning, the Detroit Free Press, took me up into the neighborhood, so I saw them and met the people when I collected on my paper route, carrying money and so forth. So those were some things. Just as you get towards the Sexton High School, there were just some boundaries that you just, it was like the white kids played on this end and the black kids played on the other end. We didn't really intermingle. Occasionally we'd meet in front of Sexton and play football as we got into our teens. But as far as the environment, is, if you're talking about the air and so forth, I remember distinctly in the summertime. Of course, we all had, I was one of five kids, and as any kid, the idea was to eat your dinner and get your chores done, get the dishes done, and get outside so you could play till the streetlights came on or whatever. And on those certain nights, you'd walk out, and there would just be the smell of paint. And then they were painting cars up there in the body shop or in the plant. And you would just have this smell that would just hang. As soon as you got out of your house, you could almost feel it like you were wearing it. And later on, originally we had a wood home, and then my dad had aluminum sided it, and I remember we always had to wash the house every so often, you know, with spray it down to wash off the soot and the stuff that would gather from being that close to an assembly plant. But it was never negative. It was never discussed that we didn't want to live there. I mean, that's where we lived, and that's what you lived with. There was odors in the air. There was lots of noises. Like I said, the trucks and the banging, you'd go by and you'd hear, you know, inside the factory, just the banging of metal and hammers and just all kinds of stuff. So it just became, it was all natural for me. I didn't know anything else.
So what were some of your thoughts when you were out on the street playing and you could hear them in there? Did you ever think about what they were doing or?
No, I really didn't really ever think about it, other than I knew that they built vehicles. I guess I want to say that there was as a youngster, some of my earliest memories of that front of that building was they had a garden, and it was the Fisher Body coach done in bushes and flowers, and it was gorgeous. It was built on an angle so you could see it from the street if you drove by in a vehicle. But as kids, you know, on the weekends, we'd go up and look through that, and it was just really neat to see something that was maintained meticulously to keep that coach looking so sharp and in made out of real plants and flowers and stuff. But again, I never knew. I didn't ever recognize the end product. The Fisher body plant just built bodies and shipped them about a mile away to the Oldsmobile plant. And it really never connected. That's, you know, because you never saw the final product over at Fisher. You always just saw parts of cars disappearing all the time. I didn't really recognize the end product until you'd travel with your parents or something and you'd go by these parking lots that were full of brand new vehicles all over this town. So that was, for me, it was just always just a place of they were building vehicles, but they weren't complete. So it was kind of different for me. I don't know.
You mentioned that you used to play in the semis out in the parking lot. Did you ever play in the boxcars?
Occasionally we would. I liked, there's a park called Westside Park. It's just across from the Fisher plant to the north. There's a lot of parks around here, by the way. But the trains would run, and as a kid, we would become adventurous. And if we traveled through West Side and all the way down, down Comfort Street, which is one street over from the plant, that would go down and ended at a gravel pit. And the end of the road, and the train would go down there, and it would meet the Grand River. And we would go down there and fish and stuff. So there was occasion where we jumped the train with our fishing poles and would ride it down past Willow Street towards Grand River and, at that time, Logan Street. And then we'd hop off and fish down at the gravel pit. Occasionally ride our bicycles down, play down around that gravel pit. And as I got older, in the winter, I'd walk my dog down there with a friend, hang out. But not too often would we jump the train. It was recognizably hard to get. You could get on, but it was hard to get off when it was moving.
So why did you hire into Fisher Body, Doug?
Well, I was a high school graduate and really didn't have plans for college. I would say that it was never pressured on me that I needed to get through high school and go on to college. My parents didn't push that, and I had already worked hard to, you know, make... I was taught if I wanted anything, I had to get it for myself. I remember buying my first 5-speed Stingray. But I wanted to be on my own. I was always pretty independent, and so even though I had this other job, I recognized the opportunity. My brother John told me they were hiring. He's a year older than me, and he'd already had a year in. So knowing that he was doing pretty good, that I decided to go stand in line, and that line was huge. I came to Fisher Body to have a chance to make money, and it was in my backyard, place I grew up in, so it felt comfortable.
Did John give you any helpful advice about coming into the plant?
A few things. John is due to my age, John was, he's actually 2 years older than me, but he was always at my dad's side. He's a handyman, a jack of all trades. He had taken on a welding job out in a small town called Mullican, and he had welded and stuff, so he had worked hard. He had worked in the flower shop here at Beeland's Flowers, and he'd done different things, but I knew that working at Fisher was better because he was wasn't as dangerous work as it was as welding where he was. And he shared that with my oldest brother and I, and we both got hired in.
When did you hire in?
I hired in October 4th of 1978. And it's kind of an odd story. You have to get 90 days in to be represented by your union. And so I had October, November, December. I only had close to my 90 days, but I didn't have 90 days in by the Christmas time. and the plant closes at Christmas time. And I was working the assembly line. A gentleman I stood with in line, Mike Odell, we hired in the same day. He was a utility man, and that's a person that's trained to learn all the jobs in an area rather than just one job. And since he was utility classification, he had to stay and work over Christmas. I was excited I didn't have to work over Christmas, but I didn't know if I'd ever get called back to get my 90 days in. But I, after the Christmas downtime, they did call me back, and I got my 90 days only to find out somewhere along the line I lost that week of employment. I don't know if it was because I didn't get my 90 days in the first year, but my seniority date now is 10/11/78, even though I possess the check stub from the week of October 4th of 78.
Doug, could you tell us a little bit about the hiring in process?
Yes, I'd love to. I remember, again, my brother telling me that they were taking applications. He shared that with my older brother and I. And so we found out they were taking the applications down here at Rosemary and Michigan Avenue. Came down to stand in line, and the line was long. Didn't even, again, didn't really know what went on inside that building, but obviously there was a whole lot of interest, so I thought I'd go stand with all those interested people. And I put an application in there that day, and then I don't know if it was only another week or whatever, but I heard they were taking applications again, and I went to this time they took them at the front of the Fisher Body Plant on Verlinden Avenue, and I remember getting there that morning, and he told me to be there early, and by the time I got there, it was already a line from the staircase. The front of the Fisher Body Plant entrance is down probably about 15 staircases. So you're out of sight when you go into the building. And here the line was down, up the staircase, down the street, almost back to the grade school. It was going towards Verlinden Grade School. And we just got in line and started shuffling. And I recognized the guy there. Mike Odell was... He went to Sexton High School. I went to Lansing Catholic, but we had known each other through mutual friends and so forth. So he was right in line with me. He showed up at the same time I did. And we wandered, spent the day there walking and waiting our turn to get through the line up to the front. Now, this time through, I'd heard that they had a table where when you went in and turned in your application, that there was a... On the one side of the table was the box you're going to get hired, and the other side wasn't. And it had a table skirt in front, so you really didn't know. But I didn't know the gentleman. But you always wondered which box you were going in. You didn't know which one was which. But shortly thereafter, I got the call. I was 18 years old, and they told me to report to work. So as I told you earlier, I called the boss on a Friday. I got the call Friday and told him, called my boss that I worked for at National Welding, that I wouldn't be in, that I was going to work for General Motors. And so I reported that Monday morning to General Motors, walked in the front door. They took me up to a group of offices, and it was like a conference room. They put us in there. I hired in. The room was full, so, I mean, they were hiring pretty... good group of people that day, maybe 20. And from that point on, we just sat and kind of all looked at each other, and people from all different walks, but in would walk a supervisor, and he would just look down the row, and he'd just say, you, come with me. He just waited for you to be you, and that's up you went, and you just followed somebody like a little puppy dog, and that's what was a crazy feeling, because, again, you still hadn't seen what goes on in there, even from peeking through the windows as a kid. I didn't really get it. But to walk out in there and just all of a sudden see this huge assembly line, just continuous line of workers and tools and parts, it was overwhelming. And they had gave me, a gentleman picked me, his name was Chris Pfeiffer, and he walked me up this was, the plant's huge, and he walked me up into this area, so I didn't know where I was at. Yeah, somewhere in the middle of the building, they called it 17-2, which later on became, it was just building 17. I don't know how many buildings are inside the building, but that area is where the vehicles came out of the paint department, and they had to be put onto another body hauler, which would take it down through the trim department, because they come out of the ovens after they've been painted, and there's a buffer time where they would travel and cool before you started the next part of the assembly process. And they walked me up into this area, and it was a bunch of separate lines, and they probably held, each line probably held 15 vehicles or so. And so you had the one feeding line coming out of paint and a big drop station that would drop the body down onto a body carrier, and then it would start proceeding towards where I was located. I hired right in, they took me down to this operation. There were raised platforms and stuff, but the two gentlemen were Jody Frazier and Jerry Van Alstein. And their job was to install the sunroofs, or the T-tops, on a Cutlass Supremes, I believe, back then. And they just sat me down there and said, this is where you're going to work. And they gave me a chalk pencil. And they told me to put three X's with chalk on the firewall to identify whether the car was had a half vinyl top or not. Back then, they used to have half vinyl and full vinyl tops on the vehicles. You could. So my job was just to identify which one was going to be a half vinyl, and that way the gentleman that was up in a little small tower that moved all the transfer vehicles onto separate lines to his, which where they were going to go, all I had to do was put those three X's on there, and that guy would recognize the X's and send it down a particular line to have special studs and half vinyls and stuff put on it.
What, you said you put three X's on a firewall. What's a firewall?
Well, the firewall is the place between the engine compartment and the interior of the body. And without an engine there, this is a body plant. As I told you earlier, I've only seen cars partially built. I'd never seen a finished product. So it would be on the front where there was an area with no engine, just so they could see the front of the car where the engine would go, and I would just put three X's on it. I also had to lift this little latch, and it had like a hook, and it locked the car down onto the body carrier. So that was the other part of my job. But here I'd been scared to death about the work in here, and here I got this, what I considered a gravy job. Felt guilty getting my first paycheck, and again, I hired in October. These guys were working hard, climbing in and out of these cars, taking totes full of parts and tools, and they're working on putting tracks down, screwing in T-tops, and all this work's going on. They have only, I don't know, seven car lengths to get their job done, and here I'm, they had a Cutlass bucket seat without the fabric over it. It was just the foam part, but it was a high back Cutlass bucket seat, and they had it mounted to a like a park bench. So I just sat on this cushiony seat, and I'd get up with my chalk pencil and walk down, and I could mark about four vehicles and then go back and sit down and read. These guys are working their tails off and have been there for I don't know, I come to find out later after I knew them, they'd been there a year and a half, and I had it made, I tell you. The supervisor was great. Steve Centers was the other one, and Steve had a drinking problem. It was obvious, but I learned later, you know, I think he kept a little stash in his drawer. But Chris was good, friendly, and I enjoyed working for Chris. It was no problem working for Steve because he really stayed in his office. But I had it made, and I had 60 days in, and then somebody, I didn't know who he was, a guy named John Powers, come to find out he was the general foreman or something, the boss of all these supervisors, and he saw me, and I guess he said, what's he doing? And then that was it. He said, come with me, and they took me down to the trim department. And back then we had what they called the A and B line. On one line they ran Cutlasses. On the other one they ran Delta 88s and Oldsmobile 98s, big vehicles. And they stuck me on this job where I had to put the trim along the deck lid, which is the trunk lid, where it folds down and near your bumper on the back. They had to have this chrome trimming put around it. It was three pieces. I had a little hammer, and I had to tap those on. Then I had a air gun, high-speed air gun, that I had to put seven screws in to this chrome that had to be tapped along. So I'd take the chrome and a handful of that, and then I'd tap it on. Then I'd have to grab a gun that was hanging near the line, take these self-tappers. I was wearing a pouch, and I'd have to continually fill that, but they had like a little gum on the end so it wouldn't slide on the metal, and you'd start it, and that would keep it in place until you started biting into the steel. And I put that on, and then if it also had a, I believe it was a A90 they called it, that meant it had a power trunk release, and I had to take this power trunk mechanism, use a corner of it, bend out a piece of the metal in the back of the trunk lock area, mount it up there. I had a separate gun and another big screw, and here I started working. I was working to death. You could wring my T-shirt out at this point, so my 60 days were gone, and I was learning what work was all about. I think a lesson was being taught to me. I don't know, but they came down and got me. I worked for Jerry Doan at that time, and he comes down and pulls me off the assembly line, and again, I'm just dripping. And he says, come with me. So here I go again. So I go walking, takes me down and shows me vehicles that during my pace to try to keep up with the assembly line, I had the screws had slid, the chrome had slid, and I had what they called burned. I ran the screws right through the top of the deck lid, and I hurt seven cars, and they told me one more and you're out of here. I still didn't have my 90 days in yet, so I was working under fear, stress, and I didn't burn anymore. I didn't wreck anymore, but it was a very busy job up till right up through my 90 days after that.
And what shift was that on?
I would say I've always been stuck on second shift. There was the shift thing there. Your seniority, I didn't have any. And I hired in that day thinking someday I'll get on days. 5 years later, I thought, maybe then I'd get on days, and then the workplace changed, and I think we had some layoffs or something, but then it was 10 years, still hadn't made it to days, and just came to be a conclusion that maybe when I got 15 years and I'd get to days, and I finally did about 17 years into it, I think I made it to days, and it only lasted about 4 years, and I got bumped back, so I've been on nights almost the whole time, second shift, that would come in at about 5 in the afternoon and work till almost 2 in the morning.
So what was it like on the line, 18 years old? What were some of the things that you did besides just working your tail off?
Well, times were a lot different back then as they are today. Here we are in 2006. In those days, the drinking age was 18. And I graduated from high school at 17 years old. Of course, some of my friends were already 18 in high school. So it was a whole different atmosphere. We were young kids, fully capable of buying homes, running businesses. The right to drink was just another one of those things. You could go to war, you could get married, you could do whatever you wanted at that age. So there was some... With my dad having the liquor store interest, I was always brought up around it. We all seemed to party. Another one of my oldest friend here in town, his father had a liquor store downtown Lansing called Charlie Bozo's Downtown Party Store. So we were pretty much familiar with alcohol. So that was one of the pastimes quite regularly. We would, enjoy some beverages to ease you through the work day.
And what did you do for lunches?
Well, early on, like I said, the plant was huge. You didn't have your 90 days in, and you had to get through that period. So after that 60-day period where I had all that freedom, that after that, it was just, you could get lost in the plant so easily. If you, they had a cafeteria, but didn't know how to get there, and if I got there, I didn't know how to get back. Even on a break, to go to a bathroom, you'd come down the stairs and think you could find your way back, and you'd just be amazed how quickly you get lost. And you'd ask somebody, hey, you didn't even know where, you didn't know the name of your job, you didn't know where it was located, and so you pretty much just stayed to your job and your breaks and your lunch right there, just so you didn't take the mistake of not being on that line, because they'd put you out the door. I remember that quite well.
So what were some of the other things that you did to make the... Did you enjoy check pools or...
Yes, I did. There was, there was a lot of lessons to be learned. We hired in... Back then, a lot of young people came in at the same time, and I felt we all grew up together inside the plant. It was... Made close relationships, diverse group of people. And again, with that particular time, with it only being 18 to drink, a whole group of us, it was pretty much just a lot of fun to go to work. And we'd all have radios, and we'd plan lunches, run up to McDonald's after you knew where you were at, and you'd just dash out to the parking lot, run up to a fast food joint, might stop at the party store. Just, it was unbelievable what you could fit inside of 30 minutes and get back to the assembly line. It was always a good time. I did go to the cafeteria occasionally. At that time, there used to be the supervisors were held in high regard, and they had their own parking lot, they had their own cafeteria that was just off the employees' cafeteria with the nice armchairs and those types of things. At that time, it was just like, I was a kid, so I respected adults. My dad taught me that, so there was courtesy, but they were held in high esteem, and I never really worked towards becoming a supervisor, but I knew that was a position of authority, and I gave them their due respect. That's part of that.
Do you remember a favorite supervisor?
Yes, my favorite supervisor out of 27 years now was Don Andrews. He was a big man. He'd come up and smack you on the back and send you for a ride down the... always having a good time, but expected you to do your job. And he said, don't make me do my job. That's all he said. And that was clear enough for me. You do your job and don't make me do mine. And that's what I did. And that's where I hired in Mr. Nicholson here sitting next to me in this interview. We ended up getting down into Don's area. And Earl and I, we had to drill holes. We had this floating jig. And it looked just like the shape of a car window. I think it was the two-door. Yeah, it was a two-door fixture. It would fit inside where there was no glass yet. It would lock into the place above the door into the top of the car, and it had a little arm on it and would lock into a little finger, would point up into the roof, would hold it in place, and then we'd grab this air gun again. These were drills instead of screwdrivers. We have to change these bits too, but the drills were real fine, and we would drill holes so that the next team up would be able to install the drip edge molding that would go into all these holes that we drilled, so the water would run off down those little channels and not run into your car. So, another great job, but Don Andrews was the supervisor there. We had our problems. You'd be drilling these holes up into that steel, and the metal shavings would drop down into the pit of your elbow, where your elbow bends, in the soft skin, and it would just burn. And here, you've got to get the job done. Just that might make you tip your hand and snap the drill bit, and then you're racing to put another drill bit in, key it, lock it down with the key and finish the job, because the hoist only had so much distance it could travel. It was on real big retractable casters that floated up on the ceiling above you on these rails. And I remember that. I mean, the job was great. My partner was great. But you'd get these burns, and it was just tough keeping up with the line. And I always wondered, where do all these cars go? And now that I have, you know, we were running two shifts, two separate lines, building 500 cars per shift. So 2,000 cars were leaving here, and I've been there now 28 years now before we closed the doors on May 5th of 2005. But I could never understand where all these vehicles went to. Even now today, to think that there's other assembly plants building cars out there, I thought we build them all for the whole darn nation. But it was always great. The work environment in there, the people were great. Occasionally, I would run into a job that was challenging. Something about that in there, you know, it seemed like every 6 months, you'd get good at what you did. And for some unknown reason to us, management would decide it was time to change your job. And I don't understand that even today. So as soon as you thought you were comfortable and you had your job down, next thing you know, you'd come in and it would be a day of stress. And that would lead into a couple of days of stress trying to learn a new job. Or first you were combative because you didn't want the change. And then you just learning how to change your the way you always moved your body. It was a challenge. It was always a challenge. Had some time where I did a job called overdoor rubbers. And at that time, it was a two-man operation. We did every other car. And this was replaced the old over-the-door drip channel metal. They went to a rubber. It also helped seal the door and made cut out the air noise that used to travel through the doors and the window area. Well, this had to be started with what they call a rosebud, and it was just a plastic nail with louvers and grooves on it, and you'd push it into a hole into the that was already pre-drilled into the steel down by the bottom of the windshield area, and then you would go up. And the rubber was formed in such a manner to fit over a flange all along the edge of the car. That flange was painted, but it was awful. Often had metal shavings, pieces of steel. You'd be running up that, and that steel would come right through and go right into your hand. You know, you didn't know it was there. And there was no tool for this job. There was no way to do it other than to pound it on with your hand, the palm of your hand. And we'd start at the bottom and pound this thing all the way up. Occasionally they'd give you this, you'd have a rubber hammer, but you really couldn't use it. And that job finally hurt me. I couldn't use it anymore, and they send you to the hospital, or I'd call for a hospital call, and I'd go down and your hand's all swollen, and it would just ache from pounding like a hammer. And they've created these new ergonomic helpful glove. It was a little blue nylon glove, but it had some padding mounted in the palm area and stuff. So they started issuing things like that out, and I just did that till I couldn't do it anymore, and then I had to go out on workers' comp. There's something called a 60 or 90, 6 month letter. Well, this job, I fought this job hard enough and long enough that they sent someone up, and they wrote the job down and looked at it and found out that there had been at least a dozen people hurt doing this operation. So when I finally went to my personal doctor, he told me that I wasn't going to go back to that job till they fixed the job. And I got that in writing. And so I went out on workers' comp until my hand could heal. When I went back in, they hadn't changed the job. So my doctor kept me out. There was, this six-month letter. After this was recorded and reported, they were supposed to make a physical change in the operation of that job. So you do this for day-to-day, knowing that hopefully within 6 months they were going to make a change and fix this job. And it never happened. All they did was add a third person in so that you'd have less amount of impact. And when they did add the third person, I came back to that operation.
So you're working 8-9 hours a day. Your hands are hurting. You're trying to get this job done. How do you get through the day? I mean, are you listening to music? Are you visiting with people? What are you doing? What's going through your head while all this is going on?
Well, you got partners. Everyone in an area, areas were made up primarily just like a classroom. A supervisor had a responsibility of about 20 to 30 people. You really occasionally didn't know why they needed a supervisor. I always wondered why a supervisor watched over 30 adults, and all he really did was make sure they were punched in and punched out and paid. I didn't understand. It was your job to be on the line, and you knew your job. They couldn't help you. They weren't allowed. With the union in place, the supervisor was not allowed to work on the assembly line. That's the workers' work, and it's a bargained thing to keep supervisors. If they need more people, they have to hire them, not do the work themselves. But there were good jobs, and we all had a great time. But then, like I said, on these bad jobs, my partner there was a guy named Curtis Smith. And Curtis would dress impeccably. He would come what would look like almost like church clothes. He wore dress shoes. He carried himself in a professional manner and worked that assembly line. But he also loved to sing. And I loved to sing also. And I went through... I took choral in high school. I was in choir, and so we got along great. And so even though the job was getting you down, we'd play music and sing, and then finally Curtis went out and bought what they call these karaoke machines that came out, and he brought that in, and we'd have that microphone going down there. And it was just, you found ways and things to humor yourself to pass the day away.
Did you ever, were any pranks pulled on you? Or did anybody else pull pranks on you?
Pranks are a continuous part of the workplace. Again, these are friends, mostly. Some of them maybe did it not out of fun, but a particular prank that was really, it would get you so well, was when you'd leave your operation for even the shortest amount of time. There's pranksters everywhere. But the one that got me was they would pop your air gun off. Now, these are air hoses hanging down. They'd release the gun off. They'd put a small screw into the air hose where it would connect, the nipple that would connect the gun to the air line, and then they'd put it back together, and then you'd get ready to, the line would start. You had no idea, and here you go. You know, these cars go by one a minute, more than one a minute. We were building over 60 cars in an hour. About 67, so you got a car going by you every 50-some seconds, and you're trying to keep up with the assembly line, and all of a sudden, you get up there, and your gun doesn't work, and you're going down the line, and whatever you do impacts the person behind, or the next person in front of you, so you're trying your best. You're thinking maybe it's stuck in reverse, or something, and you're checking everything. It would be something like that, that would stress you right out. I grant you it was funny, but it... In those clutch moments, and you don't want to bring attention to yourself, that was one of the pranks I thought was, you couldn't find it, you couldn't figure out what the problem was, and that would be something real simple. Other things, in those days they had what they call oilers. The airlines were oil-fed, and this wasn't necessarily a prank, but occasionally these oilers would malfunction. And it was almost like a bearing grease smell, just terrible, rank smell of this oil. And these cups sometimes would spill or leak on you, and you couldn't get it off, and it stunk so bad. And here you're stuck the rest of the day working with this spray that was on you. And I remember those, but some of the fun things were people would fill your gloves with screws, or the real bad one would be the sealer. There's this black sealer that they'd seal the windows and glass windshields and so forth, and some of the rubber components that had to be adhered, they'd squirt that stuff up in the tips of your fingers of your gloves. You wouldn't know it until you got your glove back on after your break and ready for work, and then here you go. You got this, and sometimes it would seep through, and then you got mess on the car, and you can't get it off your hand, and the cars are going by, and there's no way to stop. So you'd just be frustrated and do the best you could, be waiting on that next break so you could get yourself cleaned up. And at that time, there was also something called oleum. And they had oleum, these little metal cans. They were fire engine red. They were about as big as a Dutch oven. And they had a little, you know, like a mesh colander thing inside of it. It was spring-loaded, and you'd take rags or cotton or something, and you could dip down into it, get a little of that. It was almost like a paint thinner or a turpentine of sort, but it was called oleum, and of course none of us knew what oleum was, but you would dip into that and get your hands cleaned off, like just like a mechanic would do in a garage. And we used that to cut just about everything. You could get stuff off the car paint, you could get it off your hands. If you got something on your pants, you'd use it, only to find out later on, as we became General Motors and the UAW started putting into place, what was that called? Can't remember the acronym, but it was, they had to identify all the chemicals and products that we used. MSDS, yeah, the motor safety standards or something, but they had to tell you what everything you were working with, only to find out that a lot of the stuff we used for years was soluble, went right through your skin and into your system. So who knows what's going to happen as we all grow old. Granted, they started issuing the rubber gloves and to use the same material, but you know, it's, these things have been permeated and gone into our bodies. It's hard to say what that'll do in the future. Since I'm there, I'll say I've worked in many different places in the plant. I worked in trim, body, paint, sealer, and finally made it into the material handling department. So having worked in all different places in the plant, I've learned, met a lot of people. The thing about a assembly plant is a lot of people will just take the job that they get and stay in that location. I've met people when we closed the doors of Fisher Body Plant in May of 05 here. I'd met people that had never even been through other parts of the plant. People that worked in trim had never even seen the body shop, and they'd been here 27 years. And a lot of people just did that. They came to work, they went to their job site, and they left and went home and never ventured out. But the wonderful thing about having a union, and there was hundreds of jobs. You could put in a transfer to any job, and someday up the road, when the seniority would allow it, if there was an opening in that, had a transfer in, you'd be allowed to go to that other job. So if you recognize that you were working hard and there was, you know, you didn't think that day was ever going to come to an end, but somewhere up the road all of a sudden they'd say, yeah, you put in for that job, they had openings, you want it, you could always turn it down, but that would give you an opportunity to go do something different. So that was nice. I was thinking about how hot it got in there in the summertime. And you can't believe that this building's huge, but the top of the roof is covered in pea stone, hot tar and pea stone. You got a 90-degree day. We work second shift, so you'd come in at 5 o'clock, and them pea stone's been cooking all day on the roof. You'd walk in there, and that place was just like an oven. The building's steel. It was always 10 degrees hotter inside than it was out, and of course, lack of air movement. So it could be a real sweat box. One of the memories I have of our lunches, we, like I said, try to fit anything we could in 30 minutes, and it was amazing what all you could do in 30 minutes. But when it got real bad like that, I remember occasion where we would run, guy had a van, and we would all dash out, jump in the van, run down the street to what was Mike's Superette, I believe it was called at the time, and we'd grab a beer and jump back in the van, and they'd cruise out to a place called Village Green out behind the Lansing Mall. That's about, might have been about 3 miles from the shop. I don't know if it was that far, but it was just a group housing project, but they had a swimming pool. It wasn't public. It was their swimming pool, but it only had a 3-foot fence, and we'd come pulling up in that van and hop that fence, everybody jumping in their shorts and their T-shirts, and we'd jump right back in the van, cruise back, and go right back to work, soaking wet, just like that. But that felt good. I remember that being a real good memory of how crazy and how wild we were back when we were young. And it changed. Every 10 years, we kept growing up. We changed. I wanted to say also that I hired in October of 78. My birthday is October 19th. I'd only been there 2 weeks, and I had this gravy job I told you earlier on about 60 days of a job that I've almost felt guilty about. But they came up and they knew it was my birthday, and they let me go home. And I thought, man, this is great. I was making more money than I'd ever made. At that time, I think we hired in around $6.50 an hour. But that was the most I'd made in any job I'd been at. And here I was getting these wonderful paychecks, using a chalk pencil, and here they let me have my birthday off. I'll never forget that. My dad, he couldn't believe it. He always worked 60 hours a week with his brother running the store, and here I was getting all these special perks. But I hired in October 78. I bought my first house in March of 1979, and I married my wife in August of 79. So inside of less than a year, I had got a job, bought a house, and found my wife that I still am married to today. So, yeah, that was wonderful. Then we waited about 4 years to have children.
Could you tell me a little bit about the music in the plant?
Oh, music was, you had to have it. Factory life, factory work is very, very, it's strenuous and it's monotonous and it does take over your brain. Music is just the way to get out of the reality that you were, once you walked in the door, you were theirs. So to bring in a stereo and play your music was really nice. And everyone had their own style of music. So came a day where it kind of got to be what I call radio wars, you know, and it was the, we were making good money. So if you had people playing music you didn't like, came the day where I went out and I bought this big old blaster, and it stood, it was a 60, I think it's a 40 or 60 watt unit, and back then that was a lot of power, and it had 4 speakers inside of it. It looked like a little suitcase or a I'd bring that in and put that on, and just as the night got later and later, it'd get louder and louder. And I had a particular supervisor named Ken DeRosa. He was like a drill sergeant, conducted himself and such, and he was just, he'd always ride you, but he'd say, it's too loud. I said, if you'd stay back in your office, you wouldn't hear it. But he would always turn it down, and he'd walk away, and I'd turn it back up. And we got into this little tiff, and that's when, again, I learned that supervisors got a little more power than me. And one day, my radio was taken. He took it right off my bench and took it. Said I couldn't have it back. So I called the committee and stuff. But, you know, I knew it had gotten extreme, but he refused to give it back. So it took quite a while. I was, he had many sons in there. Kenny DeRosa had he had 4 boys working that plant. Well, his youngest one, Bruce, he and I became friends, so I kind of leveraged him. I'd have him bug his dad on Sundays at home when they'd have family dinners and stuff, and I finally got to get that radio back. But I still have it today. It's definitely a keepsake. It's still powerful. It was definitely for the times, it had automatic program search. It would advance to the next song on a cassette. It was pretty involved. But someone else would get one, just get one bigger, and pretty soon, if we'd all get on the same station, you could hear it out in the streets. But
it sounds like a pretty good sized radio. Did you carry it in and out every day, or when it was in your possession?
You know, I did carry mine in and out. A lot of people had secured fancy lockers and stuff, but usually you had to have quite a bit of seniority. And again, I'm telling you, I was fairly young then. But the higher seniority in the trades, these guys had big lockers. They had cabinets that they had crock pots, and people would be cooking dinners, and they'd have coffee pots, and they'd set up little shopping areas like candies and snacks, and there was just entrepreneurs all over in there. In the mornings or in the afternoon, you'd come in and there'd be a guy walking around with a cooler full of sandwiches. Daryl Mangles did it for years. I remember coming through with turkey or ham sandwiches, and then people did burritos, and these people that would make an extra, I don't know, $100 a week just doing concessions before, during, and after their jobs. But no, I took my radio in and out every day. I just tried to keep track of it.
Doug, you said you've been in a number of different departments. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the departments you've worked in?
Yes. I've shared with you that I've worked in trim, paint, body, sealer, and then into material handling. I've shared some of the work that I've done up in trim. Again, there's numerous jobs I've done, and I was a team leader, which was someone that would take almost the responsibility of a supervisor. Like I said, you'd make sure the line was covered. If not, you got on it until the person showed up. If they had problems, you'd cover them, help them get caught up the line, fix the problem. They needed a can call, which was a bathroom call. In the old days, back in the early days of the automobile industry, there was no way to get to the bathroom, and they actually had to can along the assembly line. Of course, it was all men then, but that's where the terminology can call came from. You'd call over your either a utility or a pickup man, and they'd let you go to the restroom and come back. They'd cover your job till you got back. I worked up in paint early on. It was in the it was called oil sanding, and back then in the paint style on the cutlasses, they actually sprayed the lower part of the car body with a deadener and then painted over it, and it had what looked like a orange peel effect. And I had what they called oil sand. I'd spray oil on the vehicle, and then I'd run a wheel with a real slight, real fine, coarse sandpaper on it. And you'd do that all day, and I had a particular part of the vehicle to do, and then it would go back through the oven and bake, and it would create this rock, stone retardant part of the car, so things that flew up off the roadway and stuff didn't chip your paint job. I worked in what was called the sealer room, and there was multiple jobs there. One was the sealer wand. I think everyone hated it because you had to get up inside the wheel wells. The cars came down from a lift well over your head, and then they would level off, but you had that amount of time, the car length, to get up inside there and squirt this portion of wheel well with this. One was a black spray, and the other one was a white kind of a glue that you kind of went down all the seams and sealed off all the seams so that when it went further through paint, it would bake and it would be, you know, actually become almost like a caulk you would put on a window or a bathroom caulk. That's how it would end up setting up after it went through the ovens. Then I had another job in Sealer called, it was a permagum. This actually was just like bubble gum or taffy, but it's, you would set out, like take a piece of cardboard, and you'd put a bit of this on a board, and then you would cut it off and put it into the car in places for, I'd stick a little metal, piece of metal that would further into the build up in trim. After it got up that far, these things, they'd lay down the body wires, which were the wires for the whole electrical system for the whole car, and then they would just fold these metal things down to hold the wires in place before they threw the carpet over the top. So, again, some people went in and did one job and stayed in one area their whole time, but it's kind of, it's much more rewarding for me to have been worked all over the plant and saw all the steps to building the car. And one time I was laid off from the trim department. They do changeovers, and I don't know if we were tooling up to a different model or something, but they shut the plant down for a period of time, part of the plant. Some of them, if you had seniority, certain groups were allowed to stay and work up to a certain seniority. Well, I went out the door for 10 months. And I was married. There was a concern about me ever getting called back. You know, really never knew anything about job security. Just one day was, one day to the next, you really didn't know what was going on. But there's something called leveling off. And when you go out the door on a layoff, you can sign this piece of paper that says, I would like to be called back according to my seniority, rather than wait for the opening to the job of which I was just laid off from. So I did that. Signed the recall piece of paper, and I got called back into the body shop. And that was, having never seen the body shop that first time, that was an unbelievable experience, because up in trim, it's clean. You could hear your radio. You could wear shorts and T-shirts. Down in this area, you're working with raw metal. It's all unpainted, silver. You got weld guns, sparks flying, raw metal edges, lots of danger. And I worked down in there. They called me back, and I had to, first job was to hang hoods. And I had a few other friends that were there. They got called in to hang the front fenders. So we are all in the same little area, so at least I knew people. But back then they had no hoists or anything. We took hoods out of a rack, had to put them on a, what would be like a bed, and put the brackets, the hinges that would, so you could raise up and down your the hood of your car. We'd have to assemble those, put them on, put them back in a rack, and then we'd do this continuously, and we'd do every third vehicle. And you actually grabbed the hood, its whole hood, by the stretching your arms out to their full length and picking a hood up and walking to the assembly line, which is moving, step up on one of these body cars while it's moving, and then two guys would come in from the side that had just put on the fenders, and they'd grab the corners of that hood, lay it down, and bolt the hood to the fenders and the framing. And it was that was a real eye-opener. There was, to see the disparity in job equity in the plant is hard to describe. There's jobs that are just, like I said, gravy, chalk pencil, and then there's jobs that are just labor intensive, where you can't imagine that people have done this every day since they hired in. So with that hiring into the body shop, there was also what they call return rights to your old department, and signed those when you came in. And so as soon as they came down and said, "Would you like to go back to trim?" I was overjoyed and happy to go back to the trim department after learning about what went on in the body shop. And later on, I was able to put in a transfer for the material department, and that was driving fork trucks. They put us through training, learned to drive flatbeds, haul parts, move different racks from semis, train cars, and then to learn how to make your way down the aisles without knocking things off, hurting anybody, got you off the assembly line, but there were still brand new dangers and hazards. And it's just been, like I said, a very rewarding life to work inside of the auto industry. I've never had to look back. I've been able to provide for my family, made lots of friends. There's always people you don't get along with everybody, but all in all, it was just a great atmosphere. During breaks, there was a time when they used to stop the assembly line and they had what they called wagons, and it was just the cafeteria crew had these little carts, and they would stock them with coffee, a coffee urn, some milk, donuts, and just some snacks and chips and stuff. And twice a day, this was a bargained benefit that was Fisher Body. I don't know that any other place had it in my recollection. But they would stop the line twice a day so you could go over, and it was 7 minutes, I think. And you'd just go right over there. You could go to the bathroom, grab a snack off that cart, and get back to your operation, and that line would start right back up. But these, they would be all over the shop. There'd be little coffee carts, or called the wagon. And that was always a pleasure. And then throughout your day, you were bargained, I think it was about 48 minutes of relief time. It was, they had what they called tag relief, and then they had mass relief. Depending on where you worked and which department, they'd have a person that would come to, they'd be responsible, say, for 8 people. And they would just, that's all they did all day. You'd start up the assembly line in the morning or the afternoon. You'd start working for almost an hour, and then this person would start his routine or her routine, and they would start replacing each person on the line and allowing them, what was bargained was, I think, 12, 12, and 14. And this, you get 3 of these throughout the day to give you a break from the assembly line, give you a chance to go to the bathroom or something. At one time it was called tag, and that person did those people. And there came a time some departments would shut the whole line down and everyone would go on break at the same time. Could be more fun. At the same time, there's not as many enough bathroom space. But on that mass relief, when I worked in trim, it was got to a point where we were able to convince the corporation to put in ping pong tables. And that got to be, it was like, it was the drug of choice. Everyone had their break and they had their own paddles, and it was competition. And that would go down there, and you played games, and they had side by side, and you'd team up, they'd do doubles, singles, and it just round robin. And I mean, you played every minute until that line kicked back up. And then if you were in material, it afforded you a few extra minutes. You might get a personal game in with another friend after everyone went back to the assembly line. But lots of different things happened on breaks, and that was just one of them. Some people just would sit down and rest their bodies. Some would run to the bathrooms. Again, these vendors, they might restock their coffee pots and all kinds of things. But a lot of different varieties of types of people and different job duties. Again, some were so stressful and strenuous, and others were so easy. And the people got the same amount of pay. It kind of amazed me to see, like I said, the disparity in the job duties throughout the plant.
Doug, you said that one of your last departments to work in was material group. Do you remember the material flow when you first hired into the plant, and how it changed when you became when you were employee in the material department?
Well, material was a preferred job, and again, there's multiple duties within material. Some people would have to empty the train cars and the trucks, and other people had to haul the parts out to storage locations around the plant, and then the other people would. Other material people would come and pick it up and deliver it to the assembly line. So there was multiple jobs within that. Again, it was a great opportunity. If you didn't like the job you had, you could put a transfer in and hopefully get to a different job. Then in time came the computers, and the computer screens, they started eliminating, they were able to eliminate people. Every time there was a through automation and robotics and computers, they're able to eliminate workers. And they could take one job and add it to multiple jobs and disperse and get rid of another headcount. I think that's the goal of the corporation, was to build a vehicle with less people. But the screens really helped a lot. I mean, a part would be needed available. They would push a button along the assembly line. It identified the part, and it would come up on a computer screen where the material driver was sitting. It's called a light board. And you'd recognize the part. You'd go, touch the screen, acknowledge that you saw that they needed it, then your name was on that. So you had to deliver it, and then after you grabbed the empty and returned it back, then you'd touch it again, and that would record how long it took you to deliver that part. They occasionally would pit worker against worker. Some people like to drive fast and get the job done. Myself, I wanted consistency. I like to see people make it a job and not eliminate work by, acting like they could do more. So I put a clock, I put a stopwatch, a little clock right on my truck, and I would make all my hauls as consistent as possible to be exactly the same. Tried to get other people to do that also.
Did any of this make you more union active?
Union's a different thing. It was great to have them. I saw a lot of different things when I first hired in. Didn't know what a union was. I went 10 years before I even got involved in the union. And the purpose for getting involved in the union was because I got tired of wanting something to get done and not getting it done. So I decided if I wanted to do anything about it, I had to get involved. So I ran. I finally ran for a position. First got active, volunteering a little bit, on the union label committee, and it's something I hold dear today. So I was on the committee. My chairman decided he was going to run for a vice president position and pulled the committee together and said he knew that two of us wanted to run for that position. He said, you guys need to decide who's going to run so that we don't separate the votes and we keep the committee. And the one gentleman who was a tradesman had more seniority than me. And he said, well, he was going to run. And I said, well, I'm going to run too. So that didn't work. And they wanted to meet me for lunch. He and another guy rode in together. They were both on the committee with me. And I just knew them on the committee. I'd never worked with them and didn't really know them. They were older. And they met me at a little diner place out here on West Saginaw. And it was discussed that I didn't have a chance and that they were tradesmen and they had the votes and they had the people. And I said, they bought my lunch. I said, well, I'm running anyway. So I did win that election by 11 votes. And I've kind of never looked back. I've ran. That's a 3-year term for that position. I ran that interim. Then I ran again, was reelected, and did that for 3 terms. What's unique about these positions at Local 602 is that the standing committees are also on the executive board. And most unions and most union structures only have what they call the original executive board, which is about 8 positions on their executive boards. With Local 602, there's 22 people on the executive board. All the standing committees have a voice, and our people run independently, and they're elected by the majority of the people. So for every general election, we'd have just numbers of people come out and run for positions. But you had to go around and solicit the whole plant for their vote. So it was a challenge. It was rewarding. It was a lot of work. It cost money. And I did that time and time again. The purpose of the union label is to help our members and the public, for that matter, to have find a union alternative when shopping for a product, trade, or service. And I took great pride in trying to find a way to keep our money in America and keep union workers building products.
We touched a little bit on your union activities. How about benefits? What is your most appreciated bargained benefit?
I had the good fortune to be a part of this history program, and I've been listening and asking that question for months now. And just last Friday, our group here went to recognize the sit-down strikers of 1937 that sat down on the job and took over the Fisher Body Plant in Flint, Michigan. They threw out the management and the Pinkerton security, and they closed off the factory because they were being overworked, underpaid, and enough was enough. These people worked unbearable conditions. There's still about a dozen of them alive today here in 2006. And my most appreciated bargain benefit is the fact that men and women that many years ago stood up, sat down, and refused to work anymore. And they stopped production of the great General Motors Corporation. And that's my most appreciated benefit, that the people stood up and recognized the United UAW as the sole bargaining agent for the automobile industry. Everything from that day forward has just gotten better and better. We've had down years and up years, but everything we've got is from that group of people, and that's my most valued benefit, was the voice of the people that took on the great corporation.
And do you think, with being the vice president at Local 602, that you'll be able to...
I think what you're trying to ask is whether I'll be able to carry on this effort, and it's truly what I'm all about. As you just said, I am the vice president now. I would tell you that I served 3 terms on the Union Label Committee. Funny thing I want to say before that, I'll never forget my first election. Got in there, I went to my first executive board meeting, and at this time I was still fairly young. And I walked in the room, and it was a lot of older gentlemen. I don't even remember that. I don't think there was a woman in there yet. Were you there yet? You were there. That was Maryland Culture was there. But I'll never forget, I sat down, and the two guys next to me said, "You're in the wrong seat." Well, I've always been pretty strong in my will, and I didn't move. I told them that I was there, and I'm one of them, and I held myself there. I didn't get up and move, and I've been going forward ever since. But after 3 terms, our local union president was put on international staff, and the presidency opened up, and I felt that I was prepared for that. And I'd always told him he was in my seat. So I ran for the president position, and I came up short. 192 votes short, as a matter of fact, from the runoff. And that is a 3-year term. So to run for the presidency, I had to resign my other executive board seat, which kind of took me out of the political loop and out of favor with those that win. That goes without saying that. Competition like that breeds a little bit of distrust or something, even though all I wanted to do was serve. So I didn't go away. I healed my wounds for about a month, but I got right back into it. Stayed on committees. I'm now on the Citizenship and Legislative, the CAP Committee, Union Label Committee, recently on the Region 1C Women's Committee. I belong to many constituency groups, and I just try to help move the labor movement forward and to bring up the standard of living for all working men and women. And now I've moved on and ran for the vice presidency, was elected. This is now to my second term. And that's my goal, is to continue on with the battle to have Lansing prosper, to build the finest automobile in the world, and to keep moving the labor movement.
They're going to, well, they've already closed the doors at Fisher Body, and you grew up around that plant. What are your feelings about the plant closing?
Well, you know, just when you said that I grew up, the plant's been there forever. It takes me right back to when I was about 8 years old. I start seeing myself. I went to Catholic school my whole life, and the Catholic schools didn't have swimming pools. And so I went to Sexton High School to learn how to swim during the summer break when I was about that young. And just reminding me that after swimming practice, I'd walk down Verlinden Avenue in front of that plant and walk into the doors of Harry's Bar. And I'd take the first booth. There used to be a jukebox on the wall, and it was a bar. It was pretty much a small bar at that time. It's grown quite large now. But I'd order a hamburger and a Pepsi and a bag of potato chips, and I'd sit in that little booth, and I'd play James Taylor, Fire and Rain. And that's just something that I'll never forget. And I'd pass through that back door and out into that little field that I told you I played ball in. But to just imagine that, I just can't imagine. It's been there ever since I moved here. The smells, the sounds. Then to end up making my living there, raising my family. All the opportunity that's been afforded me right by that building. And it's just, it's changed names. It closed as Lansing Car Assembly, but it'll always be Fisher Body to me. It's painful. I think everyone's that gets into the auto industry after the 30 and out was fought for and won, that was another bargain benefit, but that's everyone's goal, is get your 30 years in so you can get a paycheck in the mail for the rest of your life, you know, and work hard, give the company what they need and that they were going to take care of us. And that looks like it's in jeopardy today, the way the car industry's changed, economy's changed, global economy, they call it, and shipping the manufacturing base from the United States of America to low-wage countries, corporations challenging their obligation to the workers that afforded them the capital to invest in other ventures and overseas and other building. It hurts to see that, and knowing that the Fisher plant was as a dinosaur plant, was still the highest productivity plant in North America and possibly in the world, to build a car from start, from a floor pan in a body shop, to loading it on a body hauler and hauling it a mile or two across town to Oldsmobile plant, sticking it on another assembly line and walking it through that plant out the back door and either onto a semi-trailer or a train car to take it to dealerships around this country. We went to about almost 18 man-hours per car. That's what it took to put a car from Fisher Body and onto a train car. And you multiply that time the wage of an average worker at 20 man-hours per car at $25 an hour, which they say is a overpaid factory worker, and that's only $500. That's the cost of building the car. Granted, there's heating and cooling and the health care costs and things, but really the price of an automobile is hardly affected by the cost of labor. And that's a sad thing to see, that they're blaming it on overpaid factory worker. It's a farce. And that's another sad bit. But they're closing these plants, taking our jobs to other places. It's a shame. I'll definitely... I get leery. I've been taking pictures of the plant as it's being disassembled. It's definitely going to have an impact, but I'm going to keep that history for myself.
I'd like to take just a moment and ask if any of the other history team members have questions that they'd like to ask Doug Rademacher.
Doug, Marilyn Coulter.
Hi, Marilyn.
Has many of the friendships that you've made inside the plant extended outside the plant? And has a member affected your family in any way?
Absolutely. I told you who I hired in next to was Jody Fraser and Jim, and Jerry Van Alstyne. Jody's still a close friend. He attended my wedding, kind of back with our long hair and our bell bottoms. Now today he's got no hair, and he's a trainer in health and safety. And now again we're just raising our families and looking to go out. It's the guy I hired in next to, and I still see him today. We stayed, and he's union active, so we do things like that. Sitting next to me is Earl Nicholson. You know, I told you I worked on the line with him, drilling those holes for the to put the overdoor moldings on. And we've spent many times together, and over the years, here we are again, sitting here. Further down the table, Gary Judy worked in Don Andrews' area with me. I know his stories, the ones we haven't had time to put on the tape. Memories are long and continuous. Numerous people have passed through my lives and my family's lives. I've brought many people to my home. They've seen my children be born, grown up, and now my youngest is in college, and it's very rewarding. And now my leadership and my past president that I'm friends with, now he's up at Solidarity House in Detroit. It just goes on and on. And just can't say enough how a lot of relationships have continued on after the plant.
Are there any questions that we've not asked that you'd like to bring up?
I have one thing I'd like to talk about. Within the union label position, there is something called the Union Industries Trade Show, and it's held in a different city every year. This had to be one of the greatest opportunities I've had in my life within the General Motors Corporation. I call it the biggest jobs fair in America. I was the chairman of that committee. I was able to run for positions at the regional office level in Flint. I chaired that. I also co-chaired Tri-County Union Label Committee, the United Union Label Coalition. I also sit on the Michigan State AFL-CIO Union Label and Service Trades Council, putting on educational conferences around the state. The Union Industries Trade Show has grown in size. It's between 4 and 5 football fields in area. The big three put their vehicles and their concept cars in. They give vehicles away. It's free to the public. Nothing's for sale. Everything is given away, and everything in there is union made, from refrigerators to bicycles to guns to healthcare to communications to, it just goes on and on. And it's just been so rewarding to be a part of that and to draw the budget from the region and to put on this display and to promote the region and the products within there and to co-interact with all the different local unions. It's just been rewarding, leaders from all over. And it allowed me to travel all over this country, and I've met people from all different, building Boeing jets to Harley-Davidsons and on and on. It's just my contacts, some people stay within the plant, I've done so many things, and I'm so grateful for my brother telling me they were hiring that day.
Well, Doug, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to share all these memories.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you.
If you'd ever like anything more, I'd be glad to add. I like to talk. Enjoy. I hope. I wish us all well in the future. We've been very blessed. We've proven ourselves as a labor movement. The abilities of Lansing are recognized worldwide. And we're going to move on to a new investment. General Motors put $3.1 billion into Delta Township, and we're going to move out there. Out with the old and in with the new.
Solidarity.
Solidarity, solidarity, solidarity.